Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Beth Emmanuel is committed to proclaiming the vital gospel message of the coming kingdom of heaven. If you share our passion for this message, please support this teaching ministry and messianic community with your prayers and financial contributions. To learn how, click the support button at BethEmmanuel.org.
Last week, in our introduction to apocalyptic literature and the book of Revelation, we learned a couple things about apocalypse. We learned that the book of Revelation contains an apocalypse. It contains an unveiling which God vouchsafed to his son Yeshua, right? Who entrusted it to his angel, who passed it to John, who in turn wrote down all that he saw and all that he heard, and he delivered it to the seven assemblies of his apostolate there in Asia Minor. And ultimately then to us, it comes to us. This is the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants the things that must soon take place. He made it known by sending his angel to his servant John, who bore witness to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ, even to all that he saw. It goes on, the Apostle John explains in verse 9 that he received this apocalypse while he was sojourning on the island of Patmos. He says, I, John, your brother and partner, in the tribulation and the kingdom and the patient endurance that are in Jesus, in Yeshua, I was on the island called Patmos on account of the word of God and the testimony of Jesus, the testimony of Yeshua. So that's what I'm interested in for tonight. How did John end up on the island of Patmos, a small island, a Greek island in the Aegean Sea? How did John end up on Patmos? And it's a long story, and you can get the details from my work in Torah Club Chronicles of the Apostles. If you want to get the details tonight, I'm just going to give you an overview, a quick overview. I'll tell you the story of how John arrived in Patmos. But I'd like to start 36 years before he did, when John the son of Zebedee and his brother James were still following after the master along with the other 10 disciples from the Galilee. And it happened that as they made their way up to Jerusalem for the festival of Passover, following the master to what would be his last Passover with them, that at some place near the city of Jericho, the wife of Zebedee took her two sons, her two grown adult sons, and she grabbed one by, you know, grabbed each one by the earlobe and dragged them up, approached the master. Her name was Shulamit, if you like. It's a common name in those days. It says, or we say Salome, or Salome, some people say. It says, then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came to Yeshua with her sons, bowing down and making a request of him. And he said to her, what do you wish? And she said to him, command that in your kingdom these two sons of mine may sit on your right, one on your right and one on your left. And in the story, the master doesn't reply to Salome. Instead, he turns his attention to these two young men, James and John, who were there with their mother and along with Simon Peter. These two, James and John, they belong to the inner circle of his disciples. They're the three that are closest to the master. And John is even called the beloved disciple. It's like his favorite disciple. And at the time, you know, I think John's still a young man. He's still in his early 20s, unmarried. And the master turns to these young men and he says to them, says, you don't know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup I am about to drink? And they reply without hesitation, we are able. And he studies them for a few more moments, I think, looking into their eyes, looking past their eyes, and perhaps as a prophet, seeing something of their ultimate futures. And he says to them, my cup you shall drink. But to sit on my right and to sit on my left, this doesn't belong to me to give. but for it's for those whom it has been prepared by my Father. And this story should probably be measured against the story of the Transfiguration, which came earlier in the Gospel when the Master said to his disciples, some of you standing here will not taste death before you see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. And then he took aside three disciples, James, John, and Simon Peter, and he brought them up the high mountain. The cup of the Master that he predicts that James and John will certainly drink is the cup of suffering, the cup of martyrdom. So it's significant, since they will drink the cup of martyrdom, and since they requested to be seated on his right and on his left, it's significant that James, the son of Zebedee, the brother of John, was the first of the 12 to die. He was the first of the 12, the first martyr of those disciples. He was arrested by King Agrippa I, and he was beheaded. And he became the first to drink the Master's cup. But John, on the other hand, was the last survivor of the Master's 12 disciples. The very last survivor. The last to drink the cup. Here they are then, on his left and on his right. I think you have to imagine it like a table where the Master takes a drink from the cup and passes it to the man on his left, who takes a sip and passes it to the man next to him, who takes a sip and passes it until the cup has made its way all the way around the table to the last man. The man seated on his right is the last to taste the cup. And that man is John, the son of Zebedee, the last to drink the Master's cup, the one who did not taste death before he saw the Master coming in his kingdom. Well, sort of. Sort of. That's kind of my take on the revelation, the apocalypse of John, the apocalypse that he sees on Patmos, where he actually beholds, although in a vision, he sees the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. But here's a question. Was John ever martyred? Did he ever taste that cup? On the contrary, church tradition says John lived to an advanced age, about 100, and died a natural death. So how can we speak of him drinking the Master's cup, the same cup that his brother James drank? The church father Jerome points out, he says, John did taste the cup of martyrdom in a vat of oil. Two things are certain. What are they? Death and taxes. This is a story about both. It began with a tax problem. When the Roman Emperor Vespasian conquered Jerusalem and stamped out the Jewish revolt, he enacted two special measures. After the fall of Jerusalem, he enacted two special measures. First of all, he imposed a severe punishing penalty on Jewish households throughout the Roman Empire. It was a tax called Fiscus Judaicus. That just means the Jewish tax. The Fiscus Judaicus was a 2 drachma annual poll tax on every Jew. It was a heavy load to bear, especially for Jewish households, which might have as many as 10 children or something like this. And it's this happened every year. Every year the Romans would come, and nobody else in the whole world had to pay this special tax. And what's worse, Vespasian levied this tax specifically for the temple of Jupiter, the temple of Zeus. It was a symbolic gesture which was supposed to indicate that the God of Israel had been defeated by the God of Rome. And in addition to this punishing tax, this shameful tax, this embarrassing, scandalous tax, Vespasian began a campaign to prevent the Messiah from coming by hunting down and killing the descendants of the house of David. So he began a campaign against the sons of David, against anyone with Davidic blood. And so we read in Eusebius's Ecclesiastical History, Eusebius, the 4th century church historian, he says, after the conquest of Jerusalem. Vespasian gave orders that everyone who belonged to the lineage of David should be sought out in order that none of the royal race might be left among the Jews. Because of this, a most terrible persecution again hung over the Jews. All right, so that was in 70 Common Era, 70, 71, 72, 73. But some 20 years later, when Vespasian's wicked son Domitian became emperor in the 90s, remember the 90s? Domitian bankrupted the empire and he needed to raise money. And so one place he looked was the Jewish tax. And he discovered that some Jews had been concealing their identity as Jews in order to avoid paying the tax. No surprise there. Tax evaders. Now, Domitian is an interesting character. He's a religious guy. Whereas his father and his brother had been, they were from the army. They were secular, more secular in their approach to things. But Domitian was superstitiously religious, and he observed. He especially honored Zeus and Jupiter, and he restored the temple of Jupiter, which had burned during Titus's reign, and he covered it with a golden roof. And not only did he reverence the gods more than his father and his brother had done, but he reverenced himself as a god more than his father and his brother had done in their turns. Neither Vespasian nor Titus had taken that whole thing about the Roman emperor as the god very seriously. But Domitian took it very seriously, much as Nero had done. And he brought the emperor cult back to the front and center. He decorated Rome with hundreds of images of himself, like on every street corner. Many of them were of silver and gold, and he built a temple for the worship of the Flavian family, his family, and he demanded that everyone in the empire had to address him as my Lord and my God, our master, our Lord, and our God, Domitian. And he had this strange sadistic streak about him too that was reminiscent of Nero, and the believers begin to think that, they begin to think of the possibility that this could be a second Nero, or perhaps the spirit of Nero was in him. Somehow he was Nero rebooted, Nero reborn. Anyway, so Domitian has this problem. He's spent a lot of money. He needs to raise revenue. And so he orders investigations to find these tax evaders. And he encourages his citizens to report anyone that they suspected of secretly being Jewish. Anyone who might secretly be Jewish, but they're hiding the fact that they're Jewish in order to not have to pay taxes, to pay the Jewish tax. And he tells people to inform on their neighbors and if they suspect. And this led to something that Domitian had not anticipated. He thought he would find a few Jewish tax evaders, but what he was not expecting was that he would find hundreds and even thousands of accusations about people, not about secret Jews, but about Gentiles who had drifted into Jewish ways all over Rome, all over the capital, all over the empire. God-fearing Gentile believers who had abandoned the old gods and begun to worship the God of the Jews inexplicably. And they were keeping the Sabbath day and they were worshiping in the Jewish manner. And the Roman histories talk about these people as those who drifted into Jewish ways. And from the Roman perspective, they were illegal. They were legal Jews hiding their Jewishness in order to avoid paying taxes. And in Judaism, although Judaism itself was a legal religion, it was only legal for Jews to practice it. Okay, so if you were not Jewish, it was illegal for you to be. If you practiced Judaism and you weren't Jewish, that was called atheism. To believe in the God of Israel was considered atheism in the Roman Empire. So Domitian, you know, he's a very religious person. He was appalled at the idea, you know, he's like, in gods we trust, you know. He was appalled at the idea of good Roman citizens and other Gentiles in the empire forsaking the gods, adopting atheism, Jewish monotheism. So he decided, you know, whose fault is this anyway? It's the Jews. He's decided to launch a persecution to punish the Jewish community because they're the ones who have, he blamed the Jewish community for secretly influencing and seducing and proselytizing the populace with their atheistic ideas. So he's going to publish an edict against all, He even finds that people in his own household, the people closest to him, his own cousin and his niece, his cousin and his niece who are his next of kin, and their children, their two little boys that he himself adopted, who were supposed to be his heirs, supposed to be the next emperor of Rome after him, they were all part of this too. Believers. Which is an amazing thought. Because we're only, what's it been right now? It's like 90, I'm talking about 90, 95. We're, what is that? I gotta do the math. 60 years, around 60 years after the resurrection. And already in the imperial household, the next heir of the Roman Empire is a disciple of our master. That's amazing. Anyway, Domitian, he finds out about this. He's going to punish the Jewish people for this. And then so, you know, some prominent Jewish leaders step forward to petition him to spare the Jewish people. And they point out, they say, look, this isn't our fault. You can't hold the whole Jewish community responsible for the acts of just a few ne'er-do-wells. They pointed out that, you know, this is it's this one sect. This is called the sect of the Nazarenes, the Christians, the Jewish believers in Yeshua. You know, them, yes, but you can't take down the whole nation for this one little cult within the people. So he canceled his plans to persecute the Jewish community, and he gave new orders calling on informers to identify these Christians. He wanted them separated out from the Jewish people, and he made a distinction declaring Judaism to be legal only for tax-paying Jews, of course, who were recognized as Jews by the Jewish authorities, by the synagogue, and it was not legal then for Gentiles, and the Gentiles convicted of practicing it were to be arrested. And once they're arrested, their possessions were to be seized by the state. And you know, if they were not noblemen and aristocrats, they could be put to death. Noblemen and aristocrats were exiled. Banished is the word. They were banished to remote islands off the coast of Italy and in the Aegean. And then their estates were seized by the government. He renewed his father's campaign against the house of David. He waged war against the house of David and against the believers, primarily because he was afraid. He was afraid of Jewish monotheism. He was afraid that this was angering the gods, and he was afraid of the house of David. Let me explain why he's afraid of the house of David, because I think this is very important. He was afraid of the house of David, and he was afraid of the coming of Messiah. And you have to ask, how did he even know about the coming of the Messiah? Well, He had a Jewish advisor in his household by the name of Flavius Josephus. When his father, when Domitian's father Vespasian was at war with the Jews, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai prophesied that Vespasian would be the next emperor, and Flavius Josephus. And Josephus went even further. He interpreted the prophecies. He went so far as to prophesy that. The prophecies about a coming Messiah were fulfilled in the house of Vespasian. So this is why one of the reasons we consider him to be a traitor. So they were fulfilled in Vespasian and Titus and ultimately in Domitian. Therefore, Josephus more or less appointed the Flavian house into the position of Antichrist, false Messiah. Domitian took these prophecies seriously. He saw the legitimate heirs to the house of David to be a legitimate threat to the security of his throne, so he began to hunt down the house of David. And in the midst of this great debacle, Domitian heard that one of the original followers, one of the original disciples of Yeshua of Nazareth, one of the original founders of the hated cult of the Christians, was still alive and living in Ephesus. Because in those days, John, who's already in his 90s or so, is still serving as an apostle, overseeing the assemblies of Messiah in Asia Minor from within Ephesus. It's the fourth century historian Eusebius tells us this. He says, John, the apostle and gospel writer, who is still alive, was condemned to dwell on the island of Patmos because of his testimony to the divine word. All right. Church tradition fills in the details of how that happened. John was arrested, he was brought before Domitian, and he was sentenced to death. Not banishment, but sentenced to death. And according to the tradition, he was given a cup of poison to drink. And the Romans were into poison. They were adept with poison. They used poison quite a bit, mostly on each other. You know, especially within these imperial households. They knew how to poison someone. But miraculously, the poison did not work, as our master had predicted regarding his apostles. If they drink any deadly poison, it will not hurt them. So frustrated, Domitian tried again. He decided to make a public display of John by executing him, by boiling him in oil. You see, this is a very old icon. Pictures John being dropped into a pot of boiling oil, but there's an angel protecting him. Tertullian, one of the early church writers, mentions this episode along with Simon Peter's crucifixion and Paul's beheading at Rome. He says, the city of Rome is where Peter suffered like his master, where Paul won his crown in a death like John's, where the apostle John was first plunged, unhurt, into boiling oil, and thence relegated to his island exile. So Christian tradition places the scene of the action at the Latin Gate in Rome, the Church of San Giovanni. The Latin Gate allegedly marks the location where the miracle occurred. Well, you know what? The wall lines have changed since those days, and the Latin Gate isn't where the Latin Gate used to be. But nevertheless, the church remembers a local legend of where this happened. The story is told in a medieval collection called The Golden Legend. It says, by Domitian's order, John was brought to Rome, and all his hair was cut off in mockery. Then at the city portal called the Latin Gate, he was plunged into a cauldron of hot oil over a blazing fire, but felt no pain and came out unscathed. I don't know if you've ever heard of this before, but execution by immersion in boiling was a not unusual form of punishment. So, you know, you say cruel and unusual. It was cruel and usual form of punishment, a grisly death which was practiced in the ancient world even up until the Middle Ages. Executions of this type were carried out by immersing a victim in a large cauldron, a large tub of something. It didn't have to be oil. It could be boiling water. It could be boiling tar. It could be boiling fat. Anything that'll boil will do. What you do is you drop the person. Sometimes, you know, there's two ways to do this. You can start, you can heat the thing slowly like the frog in the pot, you know. And so you put the person in first and then heat it with them in there. Or you can just drop them in head first usually. Executioners would use like a hook and a pulley system to lower and raise the victim. And this would draw a big crowd. A big crowd would come to see this horrid form of execution. It was outlawed finally in the 16th century. The Golden Legend says, when even the cauldron did not deter John from preaching Christ, by order of Domitian. He was relegated to the island of Patmos. Relegated. In cases where a lower class man might receive the death penalty, an aristocrat was punished with banishment. There were two types of banishment, two different kinds of banishment. The first type was you just have to leave, like you leave Rome, you can't come back. Don't come back, Jack. That was banishment. But the second type of banishment was to be relegated, that is, relegated to an island to serve out a life sentence. So John receives this relegation, this banishment, the type that an aristocrat would get. Church history says that John remained then on the island of Patmos until the death of Domitian. And Roman history says that when Domitian died, the next emperor, named Nerva, released all the political prisoners who had been incarcerated and all those who had been banished under Domitian. So the church tradition and the Roman history line up. And John returned from Patmos to Ephesus. That's the story. That's the story of how John was imprisoned on the island of Patmos. But more than that, it's the story of Domitian's persecution against the believers, which is really important if we're going to study Revelation. I needed to tell this story up front before we start to study Revelation, and that's why we did story time tonight, because this persecution against the believers provides us with the social, historical, and political backdrop, the context for the book of Revelation. And as we're going to see, Domitian's persecution and the issue with the Jewish tax was not incidental. It's not just, you know, it's necessary background information for the correct interpretation of the book of Revelation. That's my point. Moreover, the story of Domitian's persecution and the story of the Jewish tax forced a break between the synagogue and the believers, unlike anything that had ever happened before. Scholars look for, where's the breaking point? Where did Judaism and Christianity separate? Well, this would be a good place to look. Under the Domitian persecution, the only way for the Jewish community to protect their own legal status with the Roman government was to expel the believers and inform the authorities about them. And the book of Revelation will give us testimony to that going on. And the book of Revelation addresses the persecution then under Domitian. You know, most scholars date the composition of the book of Revelation to Domitian's last years. And Irenaeus, who was writing, you know, when's Irenaeus? He's like the second century. This is like the very next generation. He says, the vision of the revelation was not seen long ago, but almost in our time, towards the end of Domitian's reign. So Irenaeus is talking about something like we would be talking about something that happened in the 1940s, you know? Wasn't that long ago? The believers suffered under Domitian more than they had under any emperor before, and that includes Nero. And they begin to ask themselves, could this be the one? Could this be the Antichrist? Who else but Antichrist is going to demand to be addressed as my Lord and my God? And with his images cluttering the city of Rome and the whole empire and demanding worship, and anyone accused of being a Christian, needed to renounce the name of Messiah before a tribunal, and Gentiles accused of being a Christian could only dispel those charges by offering worship to Domitian's image and to the gods of Rome. And so Roman law, which protects Roman citizens from torture, you know that. If you're a Roman citizen, you couldn't be crucified, for example. Instead, if you're a Roman citizen, one of the things that's guaranteed you is the right to be beheaded. A merciful form of death. So believers who had Roman citizenship, and there were many, believers who had Roman citizenship were among those beheaded because of their testimony of Yeshua and because of the word of God. Those who had not worshipped the beast or his image. Other believers like John went into banishment and exile under Domitian. It says if anyone is destined for captivity, to captivity he goes. That's what we're talking about. If anyone's destined to be banished, he'll be banished. If anyone to be killed with the sword he must be killed. Here's the perseverance and the faith of the saints. And now if you hear me say these things, you might be among those who say, oh, there we have it. He's a preterist. If you know what that word means, we'll learn about what that word means and different forms of interpretation of Revelation soon. But I'll remind you, before you put me in the preterist box, remind you of what we learned last week. John was told, therefore write the things which you have seen, and the things which are, and the things which will take place after these things. John was to record the visions he has seen, the things which are, the things which will take place later, which covers a pretty broad range of history, the past, the present, and the future. And as we know, some of the content of the book pertains to events that happened before John wrote on Patmos. Some of it pertains to things that were happening while John wrote on Patmos. And some of it most certainly pertains to things that were to happen afterwards. And in fact, much of it pertains to the end of days and the future that is still coming. We learned that the past, present, future focus of Revelation then corresponds to the acclamation of the thrice holy God, who was and who is to come. Holy who was, that's past tense. Holy who is, that's present tense. And holy who is to come, that's future. That's the future. The vision John saw in Patmos then extends all the way into the future, into our future, to the kingdom of heaven on earth, when the Son of Man comes in glory with his angelic hosts. And I believe that this vision was given to him, as I said, in order to fulfill those words. There are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. And yes, as Jerome points out, John did taste the cup of martyrdom in a vat of oil.
Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.